Okay, hello and welcome to episode 48 of Dano Says So, brought to you by Trust Records as part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Today's guest is the first schoolmate I've ever had on the show. What's funny is he played a far bigger role in my life as a hardcore musician and as sort of a figurehead in the scene that I grew up in. He was a member of Unity, of Uniform Choice, circled back around years later to revisit the band Winds of Promise. He's a co-founder of Wishing Well Records. He was the first punk rocker that I saw running around in a shared landscape who was doing things where I said, I kind of want to be that guy. I don't mean to put Pat on the spot by saying that, but I think I've shared that with him before. Anyway, let's get into that talk. Pat Longery, thank you for doing this.
Daniel, it's my pleasure, and thanks for the kind words. I only have wonderful and fond memories of all those days. That's okay. For sure.
Let's talk about those days, those earliest days. 40 years ago, you know, 82, 83, right?
Right.
We were in a lot of the same rooms, went into a lot of the same spaces. They were in dangerous areas. They were violent events. And you, me, Pat Dubar from Uniform Choice, John Mastropolo from No For An Answer, Zoli Teglis, we were all private school kids. What do you think that was about? That we were, you know, drawn to that completely other world.
Well, it was interesting because I'm from Wisconsin, and my dad and mom split up when I was 10, and I was perfectly happy playing Little League and growing up in Wisconsin. My dad came out here. I followed him out here, and, you know, my dad worked at Kmart, and I lived in the apartment buildings in Tustin, in the hood in Tustin, and had a great time and loved every bit of it. It was my dad and I and my Uncle Bart, and that was it. So when I got into eighth grade, I had played football and I had played baseball at a reasonably high level. And he asked me, he goes, hey, would you want to go to a private school and maybe, you know, play those sports at a higher level against higher competition? I said, damn, yeah, I would. So that's how my route was to get to modern day.
What I remember is, you know, when people look at things now, punk rock occupies a 40 to 50 year span of time in the history of the counterculture. But for the first maybe 10 years, everything was new and everything was kind of exciting and dangerous. Do you think boredom played a role? Do you think your attraction to it was intellectual? Do you think there's anything psychological about it? Because I know for me, it was the first time I didn't feel like a complete Martian was in those punk rocks.
Yeah, I've said this. You know, it's funny. I have grown children, and growing up, the basic tenets of the punk rock hardcore scene, I take my whole life. I think that is the most influential time and the most influential people in my whole life, beside my father and my mother, were the people such as yourself, Ian MacKay, Kevin Seconds, all the boys in our little fraternity groupie type thing, which was a hardcore in Southern California. All of those lessons I took throughout my whole life and passed on to my kids about brotherhood, about strength, about being who you are, about anti-drug, about anti-obsession. And for that, it's the essence of who I am. And it's those times in my life from maybe 1980, because I'm a little bit older than you are, 79, 80, to right through to 1989. All those were formative years. It's the best of my whole life.
It's funny. I feel like I'm trying to drive a tap into the kid flipping off the camera in the JFA jeans. and you really refuse to give me anything before the 7 seconds yet. So let's talk about something. You seem to me to have always been comfortable up front and garnering a great deal of attention. I remember Flipside videos came out that would have things like 7 seconds at the Olympic and stuff. And there you were front and center. And in even earlier videos, you're somebody who would do a flip on the stage. I was attracted to that kind of out front. And I'm even remembering our high school dress code. And you seem like a guy who found every way to break it without getting busted. Has that always been a thing? I mean, even as a small child, was that a thing?
Yeah, you know, I tell you, I always wanted to be, I was always aggressive. I mean, you and I both remember, you know, boxing matches, you know, at your house and talking boxing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We, you know, I always wanted to be, and I was, listen, I'm not a big guy. I was always the smallest guy. I was always the littlest guy. So that probably had something to do with a little Napoleonic complex, but it was a positive thing. I never looked at myself as a little guy or a weak in any way. You know, I played football, I played baseball, I did everything that I wanted to do, and I never saw it that way. And that's exactly what I saw in hardcore. Hardcore allowed me to be right up front, getting kicked in the face when somebody flips off the stage at a TSOL concert at the Palladium, you know, seeing guys get stabbed in the hallways, you know, trying to, what am I going to do? Do I run away or do I go towards it? You know, there are people that generally run away from things and people who run towards them. I'm not saying I'm a hero, nothing like that, but it's like that aggression was something that I seeked out and I really relished. I loved it. And guys like yourself, like-minded people, were people that seemed to gravitate to that as well. Pat Dubar was one. That's why he and I were inseparable for about 10 years, because he was a lot like that too. Just, if we want something, let's go get it. And if you don't like it, fine. If we fail, fine. If you don't like it, fine. We hope you like it. But it's something that, you know, it's us. It's who we are at the moment that we're doing it. And to me, that's just, you know, it's becoming who you are as a young man into adulthood.
You just said something that I didn't really expect to get out of that, which is, for me, it just drew a psychological equivalency between that sort of youthful aggression and that courage and sort of the overall nature of sort of self-definition and self-determination at that age. That was kind of great to hear. It was on a little bit deeper level than I think about those times. I'm going to do something else because the listener will not know this. What Pat just did was very deft and very kind in the manner in which he referred to boxing. We had, and I think the kind of people who listen to this show will like to hear about this. We had sort of an all day long boxing thing at my house once in the 80s. I want to say it was in 88. And for the hardcore fans of that era that would be listening to this, the people, you know, banging each other in the face all that day were, you know, I think the youngest one was Regis Guerin, who went on to be in Chorus of Disapproval. It was Mike Judge, it was John Percelli, it was me, it was Pat, and it was essentially this sort of single elimination thing. Well, the day boiled down to Pat and I boxing each other. I'm gonna do it because you were kind enough not to. I've got Pat by several inches and a few dozen pounds, and the man beat the dog shit out of him. And he was kind enough not to say it here in this interview.
Oh, let me tell you something. That was a lot of fun. There's nothing like getting hit and hitting people. It's a lot of fun, especially when everybody is, you know, you get mad in the moment, but it sure is a hell of a lot of fun.
Well, you and I have given at least the first 15 minutes of this thing to an analysis of being a couple of meatheads. It's fantastic. Let's talk about making music, Pat.
Sure.
Early stuff. I'm thinking very specifically of the Unity You Are One record, but also of the songs that you participated on in Screaming for Change, but mostly the Unity 7-inch, really fast, really direct, and very clear in its intentions and in its message. What I want to ask you is, first off, was it sort of life that directly influenced that? Was it other artists? And then when you started facilitating other people's music with a record label, did you apply those same standards or those same expectations to the artists?
Well, with regards to Unity, it was what I was going on and what I was feeling, to bring back to what we had talked about in the beginning of, you know, everybody's 15, 16, 17 years old. Everybody, you know, gets mad at their parents or is mad about something they can't control. And there's a lot of lyrics, especially hardcore lyrics, that have come out because of that. That's exactly where it came out for me. It was pouring on paper. It was something that I, you know, wanted to be a part of, even a small little cog in the hardcore scene, which I thought was just like the greatest thing in the whole world, with Slapshots and Rites of Spring and Dag Nasties and the Minor Threats and Black Flags and all these guys. There were people that I looked up to and bought their records and couldn't wait to get them, like all of us did. Rip open the thing, look at the lyric sheets, read them, be philosophical with it, how it touched me. But I thought that the Unity, the lyrics that I heard, were absolutely from my heart, what I was feeling, what I was thinking. You know, we all have things where, you know, my mom and my dad got divorced and my mom was still living in Wisconsin. I don't get to see her very often, things like that. all types of things like that. But it was such a labor of love. The UR one, I wrote most of the stuff on it. My mom did the calligraphy on the back for the back titles. You know, Pat and I were figuring out what we wanted to do for the cover. And I said, hey, let's go to Miles Square Park, which is in Fountain Valley, which is in Orange County. And let's go someplace and be, you know, I want to name it UR one. And I want to get Pat just, you know, solemn and thinking. And then we got the great Gavin to paint, you know, to draw something for the back. And then I did all the lyric sheet and which led to, you know, Wishing Well, which will lead to, it kind of led into that about what do we want to do? And it was something that is such a labor of love to me. The Unity 7-inch, you know, kind of began it all, and began was the number one thing for Wishing Well, which obviously Pat and I, Pat was in Uniform Choice, and they had recorded the album and were looking to put it out somewhere. They wanted to go possibly through Discord. That didn't work out. We have, you know, we were kind of in a bit of a quandary here, what to do. And we said, you know what, why don't we put it out ourselves? Let's just see what we can do. And back then we were both going to college, and I mean, what do you do? And we just said, we're going to do it. And that was it. And that was final. And that's what we did. And we made it work, you know, going to typesetters in downtown LA, figuring out how things work, going to sketchy parts of LA and doing backward deals with people we knew were going to rip us off, but we wanted to get that album out. It wasn't about money. It was never about money or making money or anything like that. It was like, if we can manipulate this guy who thinks he's manipulating us to give us records and put them out on his dime, and we could get them, that was the greatest thing in the whole world for me. And I put my heart and soul into it all those years, and I loved it. And everything that we did, I loved.
One of the things that I remember about Wishing Well and about the first couple of years that you guys were doing the label was that it was my first real experience with guys from my hometown networking on a national. I mean, a lot of us had pen pals, right, but, you know, Blasts turning up on the label when they were several hundred miles to the north, Youth of Today turning up on the label. That was really a trip. First off, which one of those happened first?
Jeez, you got me on that one. I think it was Blast and then Youth of Today.
I think you would be right. So how does that happen? Because everybody, first off, typically bands are at least to some degree competitive, but also it's one of the things that was always uncomfortable for me about running a label was that I always felt like when I would go to an artist, I felt sort of hat in hand. How did the thing with Blast come into being? First time you guys dealt with an outside artist.
Pat really took the forefront with Blast.
Okay.
He knew them. He had talked to them. There was a mutual respect there. And he said, hey, listen, this is what we're doing. You know, we're just starting, and this is what we can do. And they were really, really good guys about it. You know, send us the artwork down. We're going to get this thing taken care of. You know, it was one of the first ones, that and Youth of Today. And to me, it was a collaboration. I looked at it as a collaboration, like, let me get this thing out. I promise I'm going to work really, really hard to get it aesthetically what you want it to look like. Because at the time, going back in my mind, I only cared about the aesthetics. I didn't care about money. I didn't care about any of that stuff, because that was nothing that was relevant to me. It was, if we can get it out and we can make it look so good, a bunch of colors, kind of similar to the t-shirt stuff. If we can get t-shirts out and get them four colors, get them on the arms, make them look unbelievable, like I would want to wear if somebody was selling it, and then sell it for $7 or $7.50 or something like that, a hooded sweatshirt for, you know, $12, $14. That's all that mattered. Putting it out, making the artist proud of their love they handed to me, you know, in the form of a package full of pictures and lyrics written, scribbled down, and that I had to kind of figure out like a jigsaw puzzle, put it all together, get the colors, get the typeset, make sure everything's the way they want it, get everything proper, maybe get a colored vinyl on there, make the labels look cool, write on the label what they thought was cool. It's just all stuff. I keep saying the thing cool, but it is. Make it look cool, because that's all I cared about. Make it look cool and make it to look 20 years or 30 years from now, you can go, I did this. This is mine. I did it. Not really about how much money I made off of it. It's, this is mine and no one can take it from me. And that's how I felt. And that's how I was privileged to deal with the bands on the label. It was a labor of love to me that they would allow me into their lives, allow Pat and I, us, into their lives to give them a transformation of what they, you know, love themselves, their passion projects, and give it back to them and get it out to a bigger audience. That was the most proud I was. That's it in a nutshell. It wasn't any deeper than that. It wasn't about money and it wasn't about anything. There were always, you know, rivalries, as you said earlier, Dan, with bands, you know, East Coast, West Coast type of stuff. And that's just the way guys were and are. That's the nature of the beast. But there was never any animosity from my part because I was privileged to be able to put those things out. And I was proud, you know, of all of them, from Vic Bondi to Grave Goods to Apology to all of them. It was just really fun to do.
You provide a perfect segue there. You had me wanting to talk about merchandising and about t-shirts because there was a time in Southern California where just the level of saturation at every, say, Fender show of Wishing Well merchandise was something I have never seen duplicated since then. And I have always sought to duplicate by trying to attach as iconic as possible designs to my band. That's just a compliment phrased to sound like a question. But what you left me wanting to chew on was when you... Sure. Well, I think it was a big impact on Gavin Oglesby as well, who you involved in the creation of a lot of that. And if there's a singular influence on my visual work, which is no great accomplishment, but if there's a singular influence on the stuff I do, it's Gavin. You know, he may be my best friend, but he's also somebody whose work I emulate. And he did a ton for you guys.
Yes. Not only was, and I don't ever use this term loosely, but not only was he a genius, he was and is such a gifted artist. When he did the things and for us, I was so, and still am, so appreciative of his expertise, his ability to go, hey, this is what I'm thinking. And he brings it back and you're like, okay, there's nothing to change. You hit it right on the button, like the Wishing Well guy. You know, the guy was supposed to be nondescript. He was nondescript. The Uniform Choice guy, the back of the Unity, so many things, the cover of Scream for Change. He was a big part of Wishing Well Records, a big part, a bigger part than people know, because he was able to legitimize our artistic vision, which I don't have the same vision at all or ability, and neither did Pat. And he afforded us that. And I was unbelievably kind and he was wonderful, just wonderful at that.
I spent 3 decades rubbing his eye and his sense of space blind. So, you know,
well, let me tell you something. Yeah. With the stuff that you have, it's shockingly good because I've gone through all of and followed your stuff as well. And it's shockingly cool how it is. I use that stupid word, but it just epitomizes what it is. It's something where I go, wow, somebody thought that is really good looking.
I think that
is great.
I think the era where we were all in the same space and when things were so much smaller, we all taught each other some fairly unique skill sets. Do you know what Gavin's first record was? First publicly published piece of anything that anybody saw, bumper stickers, anything? I do, but you know what it is?
I have no idea.
Murder in a Foreign Place front cover for Alternative Tentacles. Nice way to step into the box.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. I love that band. And I, you know, that MIA was an exceptional band.
Okay, so you mentioned Bondi and you mentioned Grave Goods, and I think you might have mentioned Apology. Those things represent a stark stylistic contrast to the early music that was on Wishing Well. Eventually, your own band became sort of a stark contrast to itself with the second Uniform Choice LP and with the EP that preceded it. What are your thoughts on that?
I remember sitting down with Pat and going, what stuff has come in? Because by that time, people would send us stuff. You know, hey, what do you think of this for your thoughts? Would you want to put this out? So we would listen to tapes and demo tapes and things, and stuff would come out, and it was a little different and interesting. And so I remember, you know, sitting down and going, what about like Vic Bondi? And we both really liked it. We liked the music and his approach to it as a real artist. So we were in a position to do it. So we did it. I looked at it this way, Dan. If I like something and it may be a bit different from the previous things that we had done before, I'm kind of a hypocrite if I'm worried about what everybody thinks about everything, because art is the eye of the beholder at the time. And that's the key. At the time in your life that you're making those decisions, you have to make those decisions from the heart. And that's what we did. I stand by all of the stuff that we put out, because in each individual case, I really liked it. I found something that I liked and Pat liked about it.
So you brought up something about it being at that time. Well, an interesting thing is to look back at things 30 years later. And this is coming from the guy who wrote About Face, about your band.
Yes, you did.
When I was pissed at the mindset I perceived, you know, sitting in Pat's room, you know, after the first Houston tour, things like that. I regret that song. It's fun to talk about now. At least you and I are, and me and certain people other are able to do it. I don't think you are and I would be able to do it. But it's an interesting thing. I regret that song in the sense that I become more and more protective of people's right to do whatever they want with their creativity and with something that they've done, whether it stylistically appeals to me or not. And even from a business standpoint, it is, for lack of a better way to put it, their business, not mine. I'm not saying we shouldn't run commentary on it, but it was an interesting thing for me to, as the decades went on, to kind of go, it's funny and it can be laughed about, but I know, even as I've been sort of vocal about some things that go on in hardcore now, I know I wouldn't write that song today.
Yeah, well, I remember when that song came out and I got it and I read the lyrics and I wasn't angry.
Yeah.
I wasn't angry at you. God's truth, I wasn't angry. I would say that I was disappointed, but not angry, because I knew you and I respected you, and I could see that the way that Uniform Choice was going, or some of the songs that were going that way, were something that it would alienated you and other people at that time. So I was disappointed that we weren't able to convey the message of, nobody's trying to make money here. Nobody's trying to sell out. Nobody thinks they're going to sell out. Nobody thinks that they're going to go on tour with Guns N' Roses in this band. All it was Dave and Vic had been playing the same music for quite a bit longer than I was in the band. Mm-hmm. So it was, let's get together and try to come up with something a little slower, maybe in some portions, and a little more thought-provoking. That doesn't mean we hit on everything. God, no. Mm-hmm. But stuff like I Am You Are and Cut of a Different Cause was just as hard as anything that we had ever done. And I loved it, especially live. Uniform Choice Live, all of those songs, some of the ones that we did from Staring Into the Sun, they were all at, you know, warp speed.
There was a 5-song rough mix cassette that Gavin and I dubbed in Courtney's bedroom, just to drown people who are listening to this and way too much inside baseball. But, you know, and it had a more urgent vocal to it, and it had a beefier production to it. It was some of the best work I think either of you ever did. I don't think I wasn't as fond of the final records. I wasn't fond of the final records, but I mean, you and I have giggled about that already. But sure. It was at the time, I think it was really common for bands and musicians to think they had a right to police one another's intentions. And I've kind of grown to think that's bullshit. Like, there are people out there doing music now, hitting the road, playing the same catalogs they played 30 years ago without adding a single new note, without exploring an inch of new space. And it does not appeal to me, and I do not spend my money on it. But you know what? It's not my place to say they can't do it.
Yeah, you know, you and I are in absolute agreement on that, Dan. It's just to go back, the 5-song that the rough that we did was, I really wish I had it, because it was considerably different than the production on the album. I remember going to Radio Tokyo, and I remember doing the recording on that. And I'm by no means a recording engineer. You know, I set my drums up and I play my drums. And then you're there, you go through the vocals, you do the backing vocals, you put it in the hands of somebody that you want it to sound a certain way. And so I have no regrets in that way. It's just, it would be nice for me to hear that one back again too, because that one was, I agree with you, a lot more urgent, a lot raw, and a lot bigger, a mm-hmm. lot meaner. Like if you saw us live, you know, it was, there was more angst in it. I'll give you that for sure. 100%.
Some of it was absolutely savage. You know, it's so let's step back. Let's look at your one Screaming for Change, Staring into the Sun, and Blood Days. I mean, there's an arc there between those two different bodies of work. What stuff do you prefer, or do you prefer?
You know, it's fun. I'm able to look at it and or listen to it, and I really like the UR1 is something, especially the first recordings. They were, there's such fond memories of going into the Casbah with Chaz, setting up all live, and playing right there, bing, every song, bam, bam, bam. That's how tight we were. Bam, 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 just like that. And I remember doing stuff like this in the middle of a song. My cymbal broke, right where the cymbal meets the arm. And I'm trying to get duct tape to put it back up. And I pull the duct tape, smack it. It comes back, hits me in the right between the eyes and slices my nose wide open, like between my eye, right between my eyes, blood everywhere. And they're like, okay, well, you know, it's rolling. You better get going. So we had to continue. We had to continue playing. And there's blood dripping down my face. I put duct tape on the wound and we just kept going. Stuff like that, I remember because I was fortunate enough to be there, about how fun that was. So I love that. I love getting back together with Johnny Mastro and with the Dale, Joe Foster, and getting together and doing those songs. That was a lot of fun. I enjoy listening to those songs when I do. Rarely listen to the stuff that I've done, but I do. And I was fortunate enough with the Boys in Uniform Choice to add a couple of the songs to Scream for Change. They allowed me to let's write a couple of songs and add it on there with you playing, because Big Pat Dyson did a fantastic job on the original tracks. And then I said, hey, Pat, you know, you're kind of all lyriced out. I got a couple of thoughts for Once I Cry and for Scream for Change. And he allowed me to do that. And I really appreciated that. So those things I love fondly. And I got to play all of those songs on the two tours and all that stuff, heads and all that stuff. It was wonderful. It was a great time. And to get into the final one with Staring into the Sun, I enjoy a lot of Staring into the Sun. There are songs that I like more than others. And there are songs I cringe at. But I have fond memories of trying to come up with new ways to inspire ourselves and inspire people. So, and it, trust me, Dan, we knew that it was a change and that there would be people that would be angry at the change, but you've got to be true to who you are, especially at the time. Like, this is what we want to do. Vic was like, oh, I've got an idea about this, and not just playing all of his downstrokes as fast as he can. And I'm like, well, I mean, we were like, let's try it. Let's do it. This is fun. This is who we are now.
Yeah. It's a funny thing. Real opinion and opinion as expressed on the social networks are two different. And it is fun to shoot down people who show up on the social networks and say, no, I love that second Uniform Choice album. I think it's better than Screaming for Change and blah, 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 blah. And I pipe in snarky as all get out. You know, I mean, I take umbrage.
Let me tell you something. Yeah. I wouldn't expect anything else. And I'd come over and we put the boxing gloves on if you were not exactly who you are, because that's what I love about you.
Well, what's funny is anybody who gets into a longer conversation will have me admit, you know, I went from Carrie Nation voice box to 411. There was a necessary exploration for me. And I think for most indie artists, worth their time. You know what I mean? I mean, let's talk about Bondi, who's to me a bit of a superhero. Well, Jonesberry and Alloy do not sound like Articles of Faith, and thank God. You know,
I remember getting the tapes of that and listening to it, because I heard it just, I knew who he was, of course. And I knew Articles of Faith. I knew all. I'm like, okay, are we going to get something like that? And then I hear the haunting agony in his voice about the stuff that he was singing. I just said, wow, that came from something I have no idea where this came from, and I wasn't expecting it. And it was, I remember going, God, this is what, to me, hardcore is. It's about stepping out of your comfort zone and about being who you are. And sometimes that is not a very popular thing to do, but, right. But you know, if you're not true to who you are, it seems like a cliche, but it's the truth. If you're not true to you, you're not going to be a very happy person for very long.
Well, at the risk of becoming hypocritical about something I said about 10 minutes ago, to me, there is nothing more nauseating than a 50-year-old doing an 18-year-old's dance and not adding any new depth to it.
Boy, I tell you what, you and I, listen, talking about, just quickly about when Joe Foster gave me a call to play in with what eventually became Winds of Promise with Joey Nelson, is that's exactly right. We're not going to, now we played live. We were fortunate enough to play a couple of shows around here, Gorilla Biscuits and things like that. And we went to Europe, so we played One Uniform Story song, a Unity song. We played, an Ignite song, but all the stuff we did was right now. What we recorded was right now, us coming up with stuff and enjoying it. And I still do have an absolute fondness for Joe Foster's ability. Even back, it reminded when I was just a kid and we were working together, my ability and his ability to kind of come up with stuff that we like. Mm-hmm. Licks, hardcore licks, Dag Nasty-ish type of DC licks that I loved, and Orange County, old Orange County, OC type of stuff, Uniform Choice, Unity stuff. Coming up with stuff, and that was just magical for me to just laugh and fight and scream at each other and laugh. And him, you know, I know a lot of people that know Joe, is he's very sarcastic, and that's exactly how I am. So we're back and forth at each other. But just to get back that after 30 years, which I never thought I was ever gonna play in a band again, let alone a hardcore band, that was something that I'll never forget. And I appreciate to Joe very much for including me and pulling me back in, because it was sure was a lot of fun. And we did a couple of albums that I really like. I like a lot of the stuff in it. It's kind of, you know, me, as Joe Nelson said, it's kind of fun playing because you're stuck in 1988. You know, I didn't through the progression in the last 30 years, because I was like, no, let's do this. And I'd hum stuff to Joe, and Joe would laugh and we'd do it. And, you know, that was fun for me.
It's interesting. You know, when I say a 15-year-old doing an 18-year-old's dance, to me, there is nothing wrong with playing old songs. It is, as you're saying, you did in Europe, and as I'm even about to do stuff with an old band of mine. It's that whole unwillingness to share your current self simultaneously with others. And yeah, things like Winds of Promise were very much in the now, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I appreciate that, even though I was stuck in, you know, like, they're like, no, I know. Joe Foster was funny. He goes, you know how I know how to play the guitar a little bit better than I did 30 years ago. I go, yeah, that's okay. I really enjoyed the stuff you were doing 30 years ago, but, you know, it's relevant for me now. So for that, I appreciate it. But I do agree with what you're saying, is guys that, you know, that are going and doing things and not sticking their neck out because they can. You know, they can if they want to. They choose not to come up with stuff. Probably, you know, I don't know, but probably because they don't want to be ridiculed. Who wants to be ridiculed? No one wants to be ridiculed. For me, I don't care. Ridicule me all you like. Just, you know, that's okay. That's who I am. You take the good with the bad. Because if you only think you're gonna glean the good, you're only gonna have half the message. And you know, I don't mind people not liking certain things that I did or disagreeing with what I did. You know, that's what a dialogue's all about. And I'm okay with that.
When you went out and played out on those songs, you did the work with Field Day, you did the time overseas, what caught you off guard? What was dramatically different now from when you were growing up?
Oh, wow. The intelligence of the audience.
Yeah.
And I mean that in a really thoughtful way. They know your history. They know what you've done. I had a couple of conversations, I think one in Prague and one, I forgot, somewhere else, with kids that were, you know, maybe 15, 16 years old, who were asking me questions and telling me things about my experiences when I was 15, 16, 17 years old, mm-hmm. in bands I was in that I forgot about. So I would sit there and laugh. Oh, do you remember you did this and you did this, you did this, and you did this, and here, you, and I would just bust up laughing. It was fun. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Listen, Pat, I've touched on most of the stones that I wanted to, and you grabbed my closer when you brought up about the boxing. That's the last thing on my outline.
Oh, no, man. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. But listen, I cannot thank you enough for giving me the time tonight, sir.
It's my pleasure, Danny, and I wish you well. And I think that what you're doing and how you're plugging along is admirable and wonderful.
Thank you. So that is episode 48 of Dano Says So. And trust me, people, I will never ask for a rematch.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.